because things continue to change and move forward, and we need to be pushing the boundaries. And that means taking risks, and that means getting things wrong. And so we're out there trying to do some of that. And if you hear nothing else today, then take some risks, and don't worry if you get it wrong, because you need to be moving forward. We're about children. Now, when I describe children, for me, they're up to about the age of 11, all right? There is that sort of cut-off point. I don't touch youth. Once they get hormones, I don't want to know, okay? So it's far too scary, and I'm not a youth worker, and I'm thrilled to bits that you are dealing with your youth so well. And it's not my expertise, and, you know, I just want to say, sorry, I don't understand them. I may have had 4 teenagers, or currently got 4 teenagers myself, but that doesn't mean I understand it. However, I do have a passion for children. And children don't start at 5 when they enter school. We know that. But actually, there is a need to engage with babes in arms for the gospel's sake. Okay? So I'm passionate about children. The gospel of Jesus Christ is right at the centre of that whole passion statement. That's deliberate, because actually we want to express that. But it's about expressions of faith. And the word appropriate. Sometimes we expect children to be mini adults, and they're not. And how they'll express their faith is very different to how you and I will express our faith. And age and development are also other key factors. And we need to be aware of that. Not all children progress at the same rate or in the same way. And we mustn't look for those things that are unreasonable to actually expect from children. So that's a little bit about what drives us and we measure. Who are fact? Well, here we go. Bunch of ugly people, okay? And there are trustees, there are key volunteers, there are staff, and we could go on. And really the purpose of that slide is to say it's not just me. We employ 2.5 people. My PA is part-time. She works part-time for me. I'm a full-time with the charity, and I have another co-worker in the schools, Avril. She is also full-time. But there are lots of key volunteers behind the scenes who do so much for us and with us. And then I have a bunch of fantastic trustees who try and keep me on the straight and narrow, and every now and then go, whoa, Simon, slow down. Just step back a minute. You might be a pioneer, but we need to get some of this sorted as well. So there's a lot of people involved with FACT. FACT today, well, again, to state the obvious, we want to be where children are. So where are you going to find children? Well, actually, no big surprise, but you'll find them in schools. Now, I'm talking about primary schools, not secondary schools. And between Avril and myself, we currently are working with in excess of 30 primary schools. And we are doing what you and I would call assemblies, okay, and working on days of RE with them. And each half term, we will see in excess of 7,000 children between the two of us. We start tomorrow on our latest round of assemblies, and in the course of 2.5 weeks, between us, we will see over 7,000 children. Okay? So those of you like numbers, there's a few numbers in there. We have already booked 52 RE days for this current academic year. We've just started 52. That will increase as we go through the year. I'm also working with preschool and nursery settings, and I would much rather be out there playing right now than standing up in front of you talking. And that's an exciting thing to be doing. Churches, across the denominations, we are deliberately a non-denominational charity, so I can work with all Christian mainline churches. I just need to remember where I am to use the right words to describe the right things, because, you know, we all have our own little words and little ways of doing things, don't we? We work locally, we work regionally, often with sort of groups of churches in the same denomination or in churches together type situations, and I do a little bit of work on the sort of national level. But again, I don't particularly like standing on stages being 3 foot above contradiction. I would much rather actually be hands-on with people down there. Training and services, they're all increasing for us. It's an exciting time. Parenting, we've heard that mentioned already, and there's a growing demand from parents for support and help. And we're looking at some new projects with grandparents, because suddenly many grandparents are thrust into now looking after their grandchildren, because both mum and dad are going out to work, and they are deputised to take little Johnny to school and maybe pick him up at the end of the day and feed him and hand him back to the parents. And these are the pressures that in the world that we live in. And they're suddenly going, whoa, I didn't sign up for this. Hang on a minute. You know, I thought I'd handed them all out and they're gone. And suddenly I'm doing it all over again. And it's very different. It's not like this when I was bringing up my children, and there's things like that. So we're looking at how we might actually develop some resources for that, and new dads as well, okay? Because dads are often alienated from the whole parenting thing and have been for decades and decades. But actually we're trying to sort of pull that back in a little bit, and helping dads engage with their children. And I want to say a lot of the sort of dad's work that seems to go on seems to be an excuse to bring the kids together, push them over there, let them play. We'll stand around and eat bacon butties and talk about the rugby, you know. And actually there needs to be some of that, but also needs to be this sense of how do we help men engage with their children? And that's another big area. So parenting is something else that we've been involved with, because that's where we find children, in the home. So what's the sort of things that we do? Okay, guess the parable. Okay, so I've got some seven-year-old boys here. This is on an RE day. What do you think the parable is that we are engaging with? I don't mind if you get it wrong. Go on, have a bash. There's a bit of mumbling going on. Wise and foolish builder. Thank you very much. Yes. They're actually involved in a science experiment. Because in RE days that we do, we are wanting to be cross-curricular, which is very important in education nowadays, linking subjects together. So they're involved in a science experiment, which is all about erosion. And what happens if you pour water onto the house as you're looking at it on the left there? What will happen to that house? Will it stay where it is, or is it going to move? What will happen if you pour water on the house that's standing on a brick? Is that going to move? Okay, you're already there, aren't you, with the spiritual bits? Don't worry, you're wanting to get in. Can I just point out, it's all boys. Not because we said to the girls, go away. But actually, as soon as we wanted to do this, the boys were there because they wanted to be hands-on and doing. So in a school environment, we're doing some science, but actually, we're telling the story of the wise and foolish builder and what we can then draw out of that. Okay, what's going on here? Here's a bit of problem solving with some morals attached. The Bible is not the only resource that we use when we're trying to teach. How many of you know the story of Burglar Bill? Oh, Alan Alberg is one. Thank you very much. It's an Alan Alberg story. It's a children's story. The story of Burglar Bill is quite simple in essence. Burglar Bill is a burglar. He goes out, he steals things from people's houses, and he brings them back to his house. One night, Burglar Bill goes out, and he finds a box in a house that he is in the process of committing burglary. He picks up the box in his hurry, takes it home. When he opens it, discovers there's a baby inside the box. So Burglar Bill thinks, that's okay, I'll look after this baby. And he starts to bring the baby up. Well, one night when Burglar Bill's in bed, Burglar Bill is burgled by Burglar Betty. That's incredibly hard to say, all right? And Burglar Betty discovers the box and discovers the baby, and Burglar Bill discovers Burglar Betty, and to cut a very long story short, they get together and they decide to get married, and it's all very lovely. But the point is this, at the end of the story, Burglar Bill decides to change his ways. He's not going to be a burglar anymore. And he decides to give everything back that he has stolen. So what these children are doing in maths, a bit of problem solving, is working out how many things that Burglar Bill can take back to the houses if they do it three at a time, how many different ways they could achieve that. Very simple. Sadly, the teacher we were working with on one occasion didn't quite get the concept and said to the class, so, how many ways can Burglar Bill steal some more things from the houses? So we had to sort of slightly correct her. So again, we're involved in cross-curricular math teaching. But there are morals going on here. We're teaching children actually it's good to put things right. And even though that comes out of a secular story, I love this photo. And I've just put Lost in Dance at the age of 5. And we were doing some music, some singing, and this child was just there. And I guess we know something about that awesomeness of engaging with God in our times of worship. But you know, God touches children in these environments as well. Now, I don't think she could necessarily identify that as exactly what was going on. Nevertheless, I could see that God was doing something for that five-year-old at that moment. Okay, what's happening on this RE day? Maths with a sting in the tail. Now, these are, I think, year five, there might be year six boys, and they're playing a game together, all playing in pairs, and the name of the game is called Putting Others First. And the object of the game is to get your opponent to win. Now, this is somewhat countercultural for children, because you win at all costs, okay? And particularly very young children have no understanding of allowing someone else to go first, let alone win. And these boys have questions when they sort of land on certain numbers, and the questions will say things like, move yourself forward six spaces, or move your opponent more forward nine spaces. What are you going to do? And we can talk to them about choices, and we can talk to them about how they might want to sacrifice their own winning and actually put others first. All the moral teaching that's going in, all the ethical teaching, but all the spiritual values that are happening as well. These are the sort of things that we're doing. How can you express the reality of God to someone with little cognitive understanding? Okay, I am famous, probably more infamous, actually might be a better word, for my puppets and the work I do with puppets. That's a very old puppet of mine. That's Dustbin Dan. Now, those of you on Facebook, all right, you Facebook him and see, because some bright student decided they would set up a page for Dustbin Dan entitled, Do You Remember Dustbin Dan? His page has got more friends than my page. And I find that a little disturbing, that he had over 1,000 hits on that page from students all around the country who are now at university studying degrees going, oh, yeah, he was brilliant. I remember him when I was at school. And I'm thinking, oh, that makes me feel very old. But actually, puppets are such a powerful tool, as I'm sure you are aware as a church. So I do a lot of puppetry. But that picture was taken actually at Manomede. Okay, that child there is deaf and has no language. So how do you express the reality of our faith, the love of Jesus, to that child? There you are, you can chew on that this morning. Because so much of what we teach and preach is all about understanding up here. That child would never achieve that. Leave that one dangling for a moment. Time to wonder. One of the things that we have just in the last 9 months launched is a new project called Time to Wonder. And it is just that, because there is no space in life to stop, to pause, to be still, to wonder. And so this is something we're doing with schools and offering to schools that we've been working with. And it's a half-day session for one class, and we break those classes into smaller groups. They rotate around certain activities, but actually it's an opportunity for them to be still. Now, if you think children can't sit still and be quiet, then you're wrong. It's actually about providing opportunities for that to happen for them. And that's what's going on there, just some pictures. And I love the picture with Avril and that little boy, because we've been talking about how unique they were, and she pulls this box out and says, I've got something in this box that is unique. There's only one like it in the whole wide world. All the kids are just waiting. She opens it, and there's a mirror. And of course, the child, they go, oh, wow. One of the tear-jerking moments that came on when we did a circle time with the children, and there was a child who had just been diagnosed on the Asperger's spectrum, on the autistic spectrum, as being Asperger's. He was a year six child. He'd taken the whole of his school life for them to actually decide on this, get that statement in place, and he struggled for the whole of his life within school. And as he sat in the circle and we asked this question, what have you learnt about yourself today? He announced to the world in his big, bold voice, as children of that type do. He said, I've learnt I'm important. I've learnt I'm special. I've learnt I'm okay the way I am. Now, I just didn't, you know, you want to grab that child and hug him, but there's a sense in which God touched that child within what we were doing because we'd had time to pause and to be. And those are the sort of things that are going on. Occasionally I do some hot seating on RE days, and I'm leaving myself wide open later on for you to ask me questions. All right, and these are genuine questions that children have asked us, okay? Why did God make the world? Why are clouds white? That's nothing to do with what's the scientific answer. Why? Why are they not blue? Why didn't God make them green? Why white? You know, why do we have God? You know? Big questions these children are asking. Where was God standing when he made the world? Now, this is a child who's not trying to be clever. This is a child who's going, hang on, I accept that God made the world. That's not an issue with this child. I take that on board. Don't prove it to me. I accept that. But in my own little head, I'm trying to think in real terms, if God is this person you keep talking about, where was he standing if he wasn't standing on the world? And he's trying to get his head round it. He's not trying to be clever. He's just trying to work it all out. That's what that question is all about. Why did God let Jesus be crucified? Wow, that's a huge, huge question, isn't it? Which we've got lovely pat answers to. But actually, the idea of sacrifice and death is something that doesn't happen in our society today, so it's a lost image. Why did God call the first person Adam and Eve? I don't know. Why did God make lots of religions? Because you want to go, oh no, hang on, oh, where's my Bible? But actually, from a child's perspective, there are all these things going out there, something spiritual, so God must be up there and he must be down to him. Why is it all so confusing? What's heaven like? Now, sometimes that's motivated by my hamster died this morning. Did it go to heaven? You know, oh, okay, hang on. What am I going to say here? My gran died last week. Was she gone to heaven? Is my gran up in the moon? All sorts of questions. And we might want to rush in and give them answers, but actually it's about allowing space for them to consider. These are some of my favourite quotes. We ask children sometimes to feedback in different ways. This is the end of an evaluation sheet that asks the question of why they'd enjoyed the day. And this child writes, because today was a brilliant day, basically, as I liked all the activities and new things I learnt. I wish every day was like RE Day. Sorry, teachers, if there are any of you out there now feeling a bit, oh, thanks very much, you know. Or this one, I like the way we worked in Simon Shutt telling stories from the Bible. I'd do it again. I loved it. And I think there is sometimes a perception in schools that RE is boring, it's pointless. And if you talk to NQTs, newly qualified teachers, they will tell you that actually when they've been at college learning to become teachers, they may have only had two or three lectures in the whole of their study time on RE. They know all about English, they know all about maths, they know all about the other subjects, they know all about classroom control, etc., etc. But actually, what's RE? I don't know. So they're not equipped or feel very ill-equipped to deal with it. And this is my favourite quote ever from a child who wrote this, was asked why they'd enjoyed the day, wrote, because it felt like Jesus and God were with me. Now, I'll tell you that this child has no faith background. Doesn't come from a family of Christians or from a family that hold any other faith. This is what a child that you might describe perhaps as being secular, having no faith association. But yet as they'd gone through the day and we talked about God and about Jesus, that's how that child described it. I had another child who told me one day that they loved the day because it gave them the warm fuzzies. What a lovely expression, the warm fuzzies. But actually, it is that sense of God doing something, isn't it? We can identify with it, but sometimes it's quite hard to actually put it into words. Okay, I want to move through quickly. What does fact do with churches? A great long list. Okay, what does fact do in the community? Other things. Okay, we're working with a certain amount of Sure Start centres. Again, they've sort of popped up, and we're saying, hey, here we are. How can we help you? And I've been doing some work with dads and things like that. So I can bring a little Christian element into it with what I'm doing. And they appreciate that as well. We've recently moved offices. For those of you who kept tabs on us, we were previously in Egham. We've now moved to Staines. Those of you know where St. Peter's Church is, the Anglican Church, on the way into Staines, the one with the big green spire. Okay, well, behind the church hall, there is the old vicarage that faces the river, and behind the vicarage is a curate's house, and we've managed to monopolise the three bedrooms upstairs in the old curate's house because they don't have a curate currently, unlikely to get one. And that has been God's provision for us recently, which is a story all of itself. What for the future? A development work with schools. We are continuing to add more and more schools and do more and more things with schools. Growth of partnerships with churches, because we really feel that we can be your arm into schools, your arm into things going on out there, and be a bit of a bridge building exercise. More personnel. At the moment, we're looking for what we're calling a new operations director stroke manager, because, you know, I'm tired of worrying about toilet rolls in the office and things like that. You know, it's somebody else needs to do that, because that's not really my ministry. More frontline schools workers as we go forward. Development of parenting programs, the expansion of the preschool work, and that's a huge area. And the development of church reps is something else that we want to achieve. So a bit of a potted history there of the work of FACT, and I hope that has captured your imagination. And just to say that I have brought with me a whole load of our latest newsletters, which I will leave out and about. Help yourself to one. But I would encourage you, if you think, oh, I'd like to be kept up to date with what's going on, then somehow sign up, scribble your name on a bit of paper, give me a card, email in and say, can you stick us on your list, please? And I would love to do that, and then I can send you begging letters, all right? So that would be really good, but you can be kept up to date. We are working with some schools in the Walton area and are looking to increase that. We've been working with Grovelands for a number of years, and actually the Methodist Church have been supporting and sponsoring and enabling that to happen with contacts that they've got there. So we've already started to do some of that. And we've got tentative connections and a sense that, you know, this is an area that is ripe for harvest in that sense. So it's interesting to hear your comments about Cleves. So let's see if I can get clever with... let's do that. And let's do that. And let's do that. How about that? Okay. As we now move on. I'm just going to take my phone out just so I can keep half an eye on the time, but just half. Okay. How will children's faith grow in the 21st century? Big question. Big, big question. Well, this is just where I hope to go in the next half an hour, 40 minutes tops, all right? I want to talk about the changing world and just paint a bit of a picture about that. I want to pose this question about belonging before believing that people often throw around. Beautiful. Well, you have to wait to see what that's about. Learning styles. I want to talk to you a little bit about that. Faith development models. A number of theologians have looked at how does faith grow. Some of the models might help us understand how our children's faith grows. Why is the sky blue? I have to wait and see what that's all about. And I want to finish with just a few words from a psalm. So that's where I'm hoping to go. Okay, we live in a changing world. That's stating the obvious, isn't it? Someone has said, actually, change is the only constant in life. That actually things are continually changing. We can't stand still, nor can we look to the past to show us what we should be doing now. That's a bit unnerving when you say things like that, isn't it? Hang on, just stop to think about that for a moment. If I'm saying to you, things are changing, but we can't look to the past to actually help us to know what to do now. Suddenly that disempowers us, doesn't it? Because a lot of what's gone before was right for then, but actually doesn't sit comfortably now. And we can find ourselves a little frustrated with this generation, because we feel ineffective, because we feel out of sorts with them. We don't understand, we can't comprehend, it doesn't seem to make sense. And change is something you either embrace and you wrestle with it, or it's something you hide from. And we all find our bolt holes and our places where we can just retreat from. And dare I say, church can be one type of place where we can retreat and hide. And that's not what it should be. However, I don't think it's hopeless. I think that if we truly start to understand some of the changes that are happening, it'll shed light on some of the things that we can do, give us understanding of some of the ways we can engage with, children, and that can be an exciting place to be. So, some of the things that have changed. Public versus private. If you were to go back about 50 years or so, faith would have resided in the public domain. It would have been perfectly reasonable for you to go into work tomorrow, and when somebody said, "What have you done at the weekend?" you say, "Well, I watched the football or watched the rugby, and then Sunday morning I went to church, and then I went to visit the mother-in-law in the afternoon." You know, that might be your life story for the weekend. And that would be okay, that's quite acceptable. Even if the person you were talking to had no church affiliation or anything like that, it was okay for you to acknowledge the fact that you went to church. You were part of that community. And the church, particularly the Anglican church, had a higher profile in the society and in the community. And therefore, if there were spiritual things to be said, they would look to the church, either local or national, to speak and to have something today. If you went into hospital, of course, when you filled in the forms, the box you would tick would be Christian. Tick, that's me. No problem at all. You might even want to put down C of E or put down, you know, nonconformist or whatever. You'd have all those boxes. The probability today is you wouldn't be supplied simply with those boxes. There would be an opportunity to simply put other or none. And most people are more comfortable now to do just that. Not to identify their personal beliefs. And what's happened is there's been a move from the public domain of faith to it becoming into the private domain. It's my faith, and what I believe is important to me, but actually it's got nothing to do with anyone else out there. It's my faith. And inadvertently, as we've emphasized that personal engagement with God, we have suddenly lost that public dimension. Those of you who love Lord of the Rings films and books and the like, there's a great quote at the beginning of the first Lord of the Rings film, and it says, "And some things that should not have been forgotten were lost. History became legend, legend became myth." And so therefore now, in the public domain, there's a lot of myth about what faith is about, what churches are about, because we don't really know. And it's all become very private. It's what I believe. It's my faith. So we've lost that public image. And that's something that has changed. Corporate versus collective acts of worship. Even up until about 15 plus years ago, in schools, there would be a daily act of worship, an assembly to you and me, okay, which would be broadly and mainly Christian. That's what the Act of Parliament says should happen. It's still the Act of Parliament, and it's still flouted. Okay, so that's what it would have said. But at that time, the school community would have gathered together for a corporate act of worship. They would have come together to be one body, the school, to worship one God together. There would have been a hymn. There would have been a prayer. That's how the day would have started. That would have been a corporate act. But of course, society said, hang on a minute, we cannot impose faith, which is now in the private domain, of course, not in the public domain. We can't impose that upon each individual. So we need to allow them all to choose to worship or not to worship, and to choose whether they're going to worship their God alongside someone else who wants to worship their God. So collectively we come together, yet as individuals. So we're all there together in a school, but actually we're worshipping God in our way, from our perspective, and we're not actually worshipping with the person next to us, merely alongside them. Now, collective acts of worship are now what happens in schools. Fine, you say. That makes sense. I understand that. But I want to suggest to you that has crept into the church. That in many churches now that I visit and see, we have ceased to worship corporately. And actually, I come to worship my God in my way on a Sunday morning. And that actually is quite a dangerous thing. And if you want to notice the change in some of the songs that we sing, there's been a shift from the use of the word "we" to the word "I" or "my." And actually, that's not bad or wrong in and of itself. All right, I'm not knocking it down. I'm saying here is the change that's happened. So we come with my personal faith to worship my God alongside other people, but actually there's not necessarily a corporate act, and that's a challenge for us. That's something that has been subtly changing, and it's come from society. It's come in, okay? Me versus the community. It's been said we live in the me generation, isn't it? And it's all about what I desire. It's all about what I demand. It's my rights. But remember, I don't want any responsibility. I want my rights, but I don't actually want to take any responsibility. One of the topics we cover on an RE days for year six children on citizenship and the idea of moving on. That sense of, you know, you're now moving on to secondary school. Let's get you ready for some of that. And you're becoming citizens in a bigger way. It's very much part of the government's push in the last few years. And we look at some simple questions that we pose to them right at the beginning of the day. We say, so what can I get? As a citizen, what can I get? And most of us are in that position. What can I get? What's in it for me? But then we pose the question, what can I give? Which is, hang on a minute, I'm not sure I really want to engage with that. What is my role? What makes a good citizen? What difference can I make? And will my role change as a teenager? And we wrestle with some of these ideas, and we go through the day looking at different things about what they can get and what they can give and what their role is and things like that. And at the very end of the day, we introduce another element, and we say to them, actually, in any society, there needs to be sacrifice. There needs to be a sense of giving, but not actually getting. And we look at that whole idea with them. How do you look after the weak in your society? Okay, we pose that question. And in this me culture, that doesn't sit comfortably when we talk about our community. Instant versus waited for. We live in an instant society, and we have done for some while, haven't we? Our instant foods, but more than just our instant foods, we now want to eat everything all year round. We won't wait for the seasons. You know, I choose, if I want, I can have anything to eat. If I want to eat a peach today, I can go and I can probably find somewhere that will sell me a peach that will have been transported from the other side of the world so that I can eat it. We won't wait for anything. We don't cook from scratch anymore, do we? We haven't got time for that. Now, I enjoy cooking. It's one of the things I enjoy doing because I enjoy eating, all right? But I have noticed, and it just amuses me when I go in the supermarkets, how you can buy mashed potato in little packets. I'm not talking about instant mash. I'm talking about mashed potatoes being mashed and put in a tray. I think, incredible. Now, here is something different. And has changed. And for those of you of a certain age, because I won't, you know, define it at the moment, all right, you're going to be going, this is just outrageous, this is terrible. And there are others of you going, yeah, and what's wrong with that? That's how I live. Yeah, where's the problem? And actually, that's some of the things we might look at this afternoon. Social media means that we don't even wait for an event to complete. I'll give you two examples. With all that snow that we had back at the beginning of the year, via Facebook, somebody decided they would organise a snowball fight on Clapham Common and just sent out their information out onto Facebook. 150 people turned up for that snowball fight within the space of an hour. All right? Instant. Communication. Social media has that effect. Social media means that the other week I was able to look at pictures of a bride and a groom at a wedding I couldn't get to 20 minutes after the service had finished. Because everybody had been there with their cameras and all going on, and had uploaded them. So I didn't need to be there. I could just go, oh, fantastic. Yeah, dress, lovely. Okay. Social media, we don't have to wait for anything. And that is the world that our children and young people live in. It's not that they're impatient, it's just everything has instant access. Longevity, how old are we going to be? statistics, they keep coming out with them, that 1 in 4 50-year-olds will live to be 100. That's the current statistic. 1 in 4 50-year-olds will live to be 100. So let's just rewind, shall we, 50 years ago, when those 50-year-olds were being born at that time in history. What was the state then? Well, at that time, the average man would retire at 65 and would be dead by 67. All right? So that is what has happened in that short period of time. Here's another statistic for you. A futurologist, those people who work out the future, what's going to be the patterns and everything else, has said that someone will eventually live to the age of 200. Now, I find that quite staggering, but if you think that's staggering, then listen to this. That person who will live to be age 200 is currently alive today. All right? Now, that opens up a whole can of worms of, wow, so hang on a minute, 70 years and 10, that's gone out the window. What does that mean for marriage? Hang on a minute. Did I really mean that? Yeah. The average undergraduate, or I beg your pardon, the average graduate who is finishing uni this summer will have between 6 and 7 careers in their lifetime. Not jobs, careers. All right? Gone are the days where you leave school, you enter a career, you stay there for 50 years, then you retire. That doesn't happen. Okay, 6 or 7 careers. I can't get my head around that. It's just awesome. There are more golden weddings celebrated today than at any other time in history. Why? Because people are living longer. Okay, and that figure will increase. So in a few years, they'll be saying there are more diamond weddings being celebrated than any other time in history. And if we hang on a little bit longer, of course, you know what's going to happen. It'll be double diamonds. I don't know what... Well, yeah, works wonders. Okay, now it shows your age. But actually, I'm not sure what 70 years of marriage is. I tell you what, let's do a little experiment, shall we? Okay, you've all got your smartphones, haven't you? You want to get your smartphone out? Come on, have a dig, find it out in your pocket. Come on, you've all got them. Don't sit in the... Okay. So now I'm going to give you permission to turn it on, or you've just put it on silent, whichever you've done. Okay, jump on to your internet provider, okay, and Google, or whichever one you'd like. See if you can find the answer to that question for me before the end of this talk, all right? What is 70 years of marriage called? You know, you reckon it's platinum? You reckon it's platinum? Are you absolutely convinced of that? Oh, platinum. Okay, what's 80 years then? If we know what 70 years is... Somebody can Google it. Come on, Sam, you can. It's uploading. That's okay. 90 years, some would say. If somebody finds an answer for 80 or 90 before I finish... Sorry? Diamond and platinum for 70. Thank you. And any idea for 80? Sorry, it's a bit unfair, isn't it? I'll let you have... If you can shout it out when you're ready, that's fine. Okay. You see, this is the instant world that we live in. This is the world in which our children operate. They come to church and they fiddle with all their electronic devices, and actually we get told as adults, turn them off, make them quiet, put them away. And you do that because you're very compliant. But children go, why? Because this is the world I live in. This is the world I live in. I sat next to a guy in church last week. Perhaps I shouldn't tell tales, but I will. And he, during the middle of the intercessory prayers, was checking the score on the Wales match. Because actually, he lives in a world where he can do that, and now he can focus on God again. And we go, oh, you can't do that. It's just not right. That's the world in which our children live. Okay? The mobile phone market is not aimed at you and me. It is targeted at 10 to 13-year-olds who, on average, change their phone between 6 and 9 months. Because we're too busy worrying about the function of the phone, and actually, for them, it is a status. Consumerism, materialism, celebrity culture, image conscious, these are all things that are changing in our world. And actually, we might want to see these as dirty words, but actually they are part of who you and I are. We are consumers. We are materialistic. We are celebrity culture focused. We are concerned about the way that we look. You got up this morning and you washed and you prepared and you came out, and actually consciously or subconsciously you were aware of what you were doing and how you were showing yourself to everyone around you. And we are very image conscious. We live in a world where we can buy things and get things done well. Now, I'm a bloke, so I do bloke shopping. I need something, I go to the shop, I buy it, I come away. All right? Bloke shopping. You all identify with that. But this next generation, regardless of gender, actually, if they need to purchase something in a hurry, and of course, onto the internet they go. And true story, my two older boys, who are 21 and 19, it was their younger sister's 15th birthday, so said to my wife, what does she want for her birthday? My wife said, well, I think her iPod speakers are a bit broken and not very good at the moment. Fine. Onto the internet. There they are. Bish, bosh, bish. Ordered, done. All sorted within about 4 minutes from posing the question of what does she want? It's bought. It's done. You know? They didn't bother to wrap them, of course. They just, oh, yeah. But we live in that society where we can buy what we want when we want it and we don't need to wait any longer for it. Education values. Now, this is a bit of a hobby horse of mine, so I need to calm down. Okay. Our society values children who have succeeded in education or through the education system. That's who's valued. By definition, children who don't succeed through the education system are not valued. And we don't like the idea of that, but yet that's the reality. The sad thing is that children who are currently starting school this September at the age of 4 will have their baseline screening to work out where they are in their abilities. Predictions will be made for those children that will follow them through to GCSEs. They're making decisions about four-year-olds and their education that will say, this child is going to be at this level, this child's going to be at this level, this child's going to be at this level. Those are our expectations. That's not to say teachers won't work hard to try and raise some of those levels, but that's the predictions that are made. And then at various points throughout their education, all of these lovely testings that go on, all right, they're all about finding statistics, all right, for the government, cynically, he says. So at key stage one, at key stage two. Key stage two, they're SATs. Apologies if you're not quite sure what SATs are, but they're a testing that goes on. The levels that are recorded there will indicate to the secondary school what they think the outcomes are going to be for GCSEs. And as we go up higher and higher, children who don't quite make the grade are effectively pushed to one side. There's less of an expectation. So excellent GCSE results, A's to C's, are the only thing that we want to talk about. Children won't tell you if they got a D or an E. Okay, we don't want to know about that. We only want to know about A's to C's. And as they then move into higher education, perhaps AS levels or A levels or BTECs or HNDs and things of that nature, again, we only want to talk about A levels that are A stars and down to B's. We only want to talk about red brick universities. And we do it in our conversations and we push. And I'm all for academic excellence. I really am. I think it's something we need to be pursuing. But we cease to value everyone else who doesn't quite fall into those groups. And I think that is a serious problem that we have with our society. And it's something that we're going to need to look at. So inadvertently, we do not value vocational courses, as we call them. Oh, it's a vocational course. It's got a stigma about it automatically, isn't it? We will value the graduate from university higher than the plumber or the electrician who's fully qualified. But you're only. And that stings. So subsequently, we are sending messages to our children, have been for a generation, that unless you excel academically, you are worthless. In the last 18 months, I've just been staggered by the number of children who have such low self-esteem. They do not believe they are any good. They do not believe they're of any value. They do not believe they've got anything to offer. And it breaks my heart when I see that happening. I do some work with St. Peter's Hospital in the schoolroom up there, and have done for a number of years. And I'm working with some secondary children. So even though I say I don't touch them, but actually they're often operating at primary school levels because these children have dropped out because they don't believe they're any good. They don't believe they can be a part of it. And it breaks my heart to see that's what we've done as a society, as we've pushed education and number crunching to the front. Okay, let me move on. What comes first? Let's have a quick think about the process of coming to faith. And I think we, with the change in the world we inhabit, has come a need to change our approach to faith development. The way we nurtured faith in previous generations isn't applicable now. Our thinking has migrated and needs to continue to change to remain effective. This is probably a model you will recognise that is now behind us. The idea that you need to behave, then we'll educate or inform you, then you'll believe, and then you'll belong. That idea that actually behaving, you need to come to church or to be with Christians, and you need to do what others are doing around you. You need to stand, you need to sit, you need to be silent at certain times, you need to sing at certain times. You need to actually have that sense of behaviour the same as everyone else. And then what happens is that you become educated about the Christian faith. We tell you about the Christian faith. We instruct you, we preach, we teach, and you become knowledgeable about Christianity. And as you then have some knowledge, of course, you have no option but to believe. It becomes blindingly obvious to you, doesn't it? If that's, you're telling me all these things, that's true, I can only believe it, that's what happens, I come to faith, and then, of course, I belong. Then I'm in. I'm part of the crowd, it's okay. So that's a model that is probably familiar to many of you. However, that's changed a little bit, or started to change, where people go, hey, we don't expect people to behave. So actually, if they don't want to wear a suit, they can come in jeans. It's okay. Yeah, they can dress differently to us. Maybe, you know, we might not think it's appropriate, but it's okay. They don't need to behave like us. But we then teach them and we'll inform them. They will then, of course, come to that point of belief. Then they'll learn to behave like us. And then, of course, they can belong. And, of course, things have then changed from there as well. So we then move to, hang on a minute, this idea of behaving like us, it really needs to be sort of dumped, doesn't it? So you come on in, as you are, we'll tell you all about the Christian faith, we'll educate you, you'll have lots of knowledge and lots of understanding, and out of that will come belief, and then you'll belong, and then hopefully you'll start to behave. But actually, if you don't, it doesn't really matter, it's fine. And then things have changed again. And people are going, whoa, 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 whoa. Let's get this now in a different order. Let's allow people to come and belong. They don't have to actually believe everything we believe, but actually let them come, let them belong as part of this group. Let them journey with us. And as they journey with us and they rub shoulders with us and they find out about who we are and have that relationship, then they'll start to believe in the God in which we believe. They'll see something in us that will make them go, I want to be like them. Yeah, there's something they've got that I want. Yeah, I believe in their God. And out of that comes education. We start to correct some of those wacky ideas they've got. I'm sure you've come across people who've come to faith in Christ later in life who perhaps have no Christian background and they believe all sorts of weird and wonderful things. You're going, whoa, hang on, alarm bells are ringing. And we start to correct some of that. And we start to help them think through what they believe in a more structured way. So we start to educate them, and hopefully they get to a point where they're going to behave. But we're not quite sure what behaviour is now. All right. I think this is where we are now needing to be, and that will change again. Unconditional belonging. Because the belonging in the previous one was, of course you can come and belong, but you're not really part of us. Of course you can belong, but you're not like us. So somehow we have two-tier systems, those on the inside, those on the outside, those are in the kingdom, those are out the kingdom. But we need to have a sense, particularly for our children, that they are unconditionally part of who we are. And that's quite hard to get to that place. And then there needs to be what we're now terming as awe and wonder. It's come full circle through the education system. It was in there, then it disappeared, now it's starting to reappear. Awe and wonder, or experience. Don't tell me about this God. Allow me to experience him. And in the last 10 years, you have seen the rise of youth church. You will have seen the rise of many other different types of churches, which seem to be very experiential. It's a lot of emotion going on there, isn't it? That'll never do for us blokes. Oh, dear me. But actually, there needs to be awe and wonder and experience for these children. They need to experience God. And if you like, some of the things you were talking about, the fact that two young people can just sit and read the Bible, we get excited about it because actually God can touch them at that point. The stuff I'm doing on RE days, actually you can see the children are being touched by God. It's exciting. Then we educate. Belief comes in there. Belief is part of that journey that goes on. They start to believe because they've experienced, and then they start to find out what it's all about. That's the process, I think, that needs to come. I wonder what you made of that. You'll have enjoyed it at all sorts of different levels. But for children and young people as well, that's about experiencing God. And out of it comes lots of questions. I want to just read a few words from Psalm 78 to you, and then I'm going to stop because time has gone. And I am going to take questions and answers session this afternoon. So if you've got things that are burning, then come and chew them with me, or grab me over coffee afterwards, either way. But I just want to finish with these words from Psalm 78. O my people, listen to my instructions. Open your ears to what I'm saying, for I will speak to you in a parable. I will teach you hidden lessons from our past, stories we have heard and known, stories our ancestors handed down to us. We will not hide these truths from our children. We will tell the next generation about the glorious deeds the Lord above has done and his mighty powers and mighty wonders. This generation needs to know. This generation needs to experience. It's not a hopeless case at all. This generation are more open to God than any previous generation. We just need to learn how to engage with him in a constructive way. Peter, can I ask you to finish with some prayer for us? Thank you.
Hasn't that been amazing? I think incredibly helpful and lots to think about. Father in heaven, thank you for what Simon has brought and for time for us to just reflect on that and put things into practice and how we need to change what we do and how we engage and are relevant in today's society without compromising the truth of who you are. Father, give us wisdom, give us insight. Pray a blessing, Father, on the children, on the young people, on the ministries involved in that, and help us how to factor in better in working with you in the now time. Pray for your blessing on parents, Father, and grandparents. Help us to be up to speed, who we are, available, connected to you, to each other and to others, in Jesus' name.